Stitcher, smart radio mobile app, offers this podcast and over 5,000 other podcasts and programs without downloading or syncing at the iPhone or Android app stores or at Stitcher.com.
My music is for Phoenix. Only she can sing it. Anyone else that tries dies.
20th Century Fox presents Phantom of the Paradise. A gothic horror story. A beautiful love story. A cinematic odyssey through the rock universe. From Greece to glitter. And beyond.
Life at last. Salutations from the other side.
The story of the Phantom who haunts the paradise. The ultimate rock palace.
This place is possessed.
He sold his soul for rock and roll. Phantom of the Paradise. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Greetings, victims. Welcome back to another spectacular episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
I know drug real from real real.
This week, we've got a special guest, Ari, the principal archivist at the Swan Archives, the most incredible site for all your Phantom facts and ephemera. Welcome, Ari.
Thanks very much. I'm honored to be here.
Glad to have you. Phantom of the Paradise from 1974 is an early entry in the filmography of Brian De Palma. It's a rock and roll retelling of the German Faust story mixed with Gaston Leroux's Phantom of the Opera. The film stars De Palma regular William Finley as Winslow Leach, a struggling songwriter who gets his work stolen by mysterious rock impresario Swan, who's played by singer-songwriter Paul Williams. Swan frames Leach and has him tossed in the can. After he escapes, he's mutilated by a record press and hides at the Paradise, Swan's theater. Along with music, between the two men is the singer Phoenix, played by Jessica Harper. She's the only one Winslow will allow to sing his music, though Swan hopes that the rock singer Beef, Garrett Graham, will open the Paradise to rave reviews. This might sound like there's a whole lot of stuff going on, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. I didn't even talk about Swan's other bands or his pact with the devil. I'm saying all this, but I know that I'm not ruining a thing for folks who haven't seen Phantom of the Paradise yet, because so much of the pleasure comes from the way that the film is put together and, of course, the music. All right, so what do you guys like or dislike about the movie? I'm going to start with Justin because I seem to remember him talking some shit about Brian De Palma in a previous episode. Now, I agree that half of De Palma's films are shit, but we can get into that a little bit more later. For now, let's look at just Phantom of the Paradise. Justin?
Well, I will actually go on record and say that more than half of Brian De Palma's films are steaming piles of poo. They're about 80% steaming piles of poo. On that note, I'm a huge admirer of Phantom of the Paradise. I think it's one of De Palma's best films, and it's got this, you know, amazing cult following, you know, and I think that's what attracts me to it as well. Is I'm a sucker for musicals, so I appreciate that aspect of the film. I'm a big fan of Jessica Harper, and I'm a big fan of Phantom of the Opera, and I appreciate the art direction of the film. I think overall it's totally amazing.
So Ari, I'd like to know something right off the bat. What's your relationship with Phantom? Why have you been dedicated to it all these years, and why the website?
Well, it's largely a sentimental favorite. I fell in love with this movie in 1975 when I was about 12 years old. And I think everyone who grows up loving movies and being interested in how they're made can point to the first movie that they saw that opened their consciousness to the fact that movies were actually created by someone and that decisions were being made about where to put the camera and how to light the scene and set the pace and the tone, and that these things were creative decisions, and that if you liked a movie, it might be a good idea to find other movies made by the same people. And so for me, Phantom was that film. And really, it's not surprising that movie making was noticeable to me because from this movie, because Phantom, like so many of Brian De Palma's movies, all of which, Justin, are masterpieces, is all about making the audience aware that they're watching a movie, even as they're, you know, swept up in its spell. With its split screen and voiceovers and ostentatious camera moves and near constant shifts in tone and even the crazy wipes and fades with Swan sailing across the screen, it constantly interrupts itself to say, hey, you're watching a movie. And as well, because it's such a personal work in that it's so iconoclastic and heartfelt in its anger and romanticism, you feel, or at least I felt, the illusion of a connection to the creative minds that worked behind it. So watching it, you feel, whether you're right or wrong, that you're getting a real insight into the personality of the filmmaker, I think. And even the camera seems to have a sense of humor. So it makes total sense to me that so many of the most interesting directors working today, like Guillermo del Toro and Edgar Wright and Quentin Tarantino cite Phantom as being a huge influence on them, and it makes sense that you guys love it as well. I have to believe that they, like me, saw Phantom in their youth and said to themselves, not just, oh, look how much fun this movie is, but look how much fun it might be to make a movie because it calls so much attention to itself as a movie. It was the first movie to make an impression on me that there were people making movies and people behind the camera, and that's kind of why it stuck with me.
Well, you know, Quentin Tarantino saw everything when he was a youth.
He did, but he points to Phantom as being a big influence for him, as does Edgar Wright. And Guillermo del Toro says he wouldn't be making movies today if it weren't for Phantom.
You said De Palma's, all of his work is masterpieces. Were you talking like masterpieces of poop?
No, I think they're masterpieces. I think that a lot of, you might take issue with the stories, the scripts, in some cases the performances, but I think that his work on every film as a director, His visual storytelling sense, his visual style is second to none. And sure, there are stories that I don't love that he's chosen to film, but I love his work on all of the films.
It's probably second to none to Hitchcock, wouldn't you think?
I actually prefer De Palma to Hitchcock, and I know that
robs
substantial credibility, and we might want to edit that out.
So, Ari, when did you start doing the website? What inspired you to finally put your love of this film onto the World Wide Web?
Well, the website, the initial idea was just I had compiled over 30 years just a whole lot of memorabilia and crap related to the film, posters and DVDs and lobby cards and so on from just about every country in the world. And it seemed like it might be fun to just throw a website out, but I didn't want it just to be some obsessive compulsive catalog of stuff. And so I thought it might be fun to actually write something and talk about how the film was made and what some of the themes were and go through it scene by scene and do some analysis, along with the plain vanilla presentation of just an obsessive compulsive collection. So that was in 2006. It was right around the time of the second Phantom Palooza.
Did you start collecting that right after you saw the film, or did you like wait a few years and then realize what an impact that made on you, or how did that go?
I started collecting it right away. You know, when the movie came out, there were no VHS tapes, there were no DVDs, and the film certainly wasn't running on TV. So when it left the theater, it was just plain gone, and you couldn't see it again. And getting stuff related to the film was sort of the best I could do as far as keeping it in my mind and staying connected to it and having reminders of how much fun I had had watching the film. At that time, there were science fiction conventions and Star Trek conventions and things like that, and there were always dealers' rooms and people selling merchandise of various kinds, and I established sort of a network of people who went to these things, as I did, and I was always on the lookout for stuff that they wanted, whether it was anything having to do with Olivia Newton John or whatever. And they knew me, a lot of them, as just that kid who was always looking for Phantom stuff. And when they found something interesting, they would pick it up for me. And when I found something they were looking for, I would pick it up for them. And it was a very sort of symbiotic internet-like relationship, but pre-internet. So over the years, I just started filling a closet with these various press books and press kits and stills and posters and trailers and that sort of thing, to the point that a few years ago when the French wanted to put out a DVD related to Phantom, a special edition, everybody was sending them to me because they couldn't find trailers anywhere. They couldn't find posters and stills for their poster gallery. And it turned out that Fox didn't have a trailer in projectable condition. So they had to get that stuff from me. And it was nice to be of help.
It's awesome.
What are some of the rarest things that you have in your collection?
Well, I think probably the most significant stuff from an archaeological or film preservation point of view is the outtakes and deleted scenes, which are featured on my site. There's probably around 40 minutes of it all told, and I got hold of the original 35mm camera negatives, or in some cases the interpositives, for each of those. They'd been sitting in film cans for about 30 years just gathering dust before I got hold of them. They're actually sitting in film cans next to me right now, and you can watch them in crippled format on my site, which is the only place you can see them. I've been waiting for Fox or Criterion or somebody to ask me for them so they can be used in a special edition Blu-ray or something, but nobody's expressed any interest yet, which is kind of a mystery to me. And I guess as far as uncovering stuff, I've also put some time into tracking down the photographers whose pictures accompanied various magazine and newspaper stories about the making of the movie in 1974. So typically a photographer would be sent with a writer who's been tasked with writing about the weird movie being filmed in our town or whatever, and he'll take dozens of pictures, of which maybe one or two would appear with the article and the rest would be lost forever. So there have been a couple of real scores where I've gotten in touch with these photographers when they've even still been alive, and they say, oh, I have all my negatives from 30 years ago sitting in the attic. And some of them have been nice enough to go looking. And so I don't know what it is about photographers. They tend to also to be excellent librarians. So a couple of weeks later, they'll call me and say, oh, I found 10 or 15 pictures I took of Brian De Palma and Paul Williams on the set that never got published or whatever. And they'll email them to me and they'll give me permission to post them on my site. So that stuff is gold because the film was shot on a shoestring budget independently with no studio support. And as far as I can tell, there was no money for an on-set photographer. So there's really very little in the way of behind-the-scenes documentation in existence. And some of the cast members and crew have also sent me photos from their own collections, which also never would have come to light if they hadn't been kind enough to look through their old photo albums and send them to me.
Tell me a little bit, as far as what you know, as how De Palma and Williams, because this thing really feels like a collaboration between those two artists. How do you feel that they got together? Because I've heard differing stories to that point.
It does seem to me to have been a collaboration. And what's funny is that people's memories are fuzzy. For example, I've heard Paul Williams and William Finley have both told me that they came up with the idea for the plunger going through the shower curtain at Beef, whereas I've looked at scripts that pre-existed their involvement, and it's already in there. So it's hard to rely on people's memories when they say who came up with what. They might all be right.
Or it could just be the decadence of the 70s, too.
It could be that there was a lot of decadence going around there.
Yeah, I, from what I've read, Paul Williams was not always in his right mind all the time in the 70s. The thing that I love about the movie, I mean, one of the things, you know, Justin, you already touched on this as far as the art direction and stuff. I love the sets and I love how everything is scaled to Swan. I mean, Paul Williams, I'm not sure exactly of his height, but the guy's got to be around like 5 foot something. And all the doors, you know, are just for him. The world around him is made for him.
That's even more the case, the idea that everything is all about Swan in the film, the way that it existed before it was edited for the Swan Song legal reasons, where you had a whole bunch of shots in the movie that opened on the Swan Song logo or the word Swan Song, and then the camera would pull back or crane down and you'd see the larger scene. And all of those opening moments of shots had to be cut out because of the legal claims of the Swan Song record company at the time.
Right, yeah, we should talk about that. That was Led Zeppelin's label.
That was their own label, yes. That was right. The label they created in the mid-70s post Led Zeppelin 4. I think Houses of the Holy or Physical Graffiti was the first album that came out on Swan Song.
And so when Brian De Palma used Swan Song in Phantom of the Paradise, there was all this legal rigmarole and they had to work around that. I mean, where were they at in the process of making this film when all of a sudden this came up? Was this, it seems like it's right at the end of it.
They were done making the film. They had sold the film to Fox for distribution when that claim came in. Swan Song first started using the name in June of 1974, and the film was scheduled to come out in October. And that's when they got threats from Peter Grant, who was Led Zeppelin's manager at the time, and who was annoyed not just because of the use of the Swan Song name, but because of Beef's electrocution. Peter Grant had previously managed a band called Stone the Crows, whose lead singer had been electrocuted on stage during a sound check. And so it just added insult to injury to him that not only were they using the Swan Song name, but that the film featured an onstage electrocution of a singer. So he threatened to spend every last dime he had blocking release of the film unless all of the prominent references to Swan Song were removed prior to release of the film. And that's why you see in the movie a lot of really awkward edits and a lot of masking of the Swan Song name. It's been covered up by a dead crow in some, or sparrow, I've never been sure what bird that is, in some scenes. And if you want to see the way that those scenes looked before the mutilation, they're up on my site, because those changed and deleted bits were among the film that fell into my hands.
But the most prominent one to me is when Swan is introducing Beef at the airport, and he's got just that horrible, like, white box floating in front of him with that dead bird on it. But I did notice when I watched it last time that you can see Swan Song here and there, but it's really tough to see.
It's there. They took it out in all the places where it was really obvious. And that scene you're referring to, it just looks horrible. You're right. It's an eyesore.
Well, yeah, it looks almost like a video effect, even though I'm sure that it wasn't a video effect at that time. But it's just like, what is going on? I thought maybe they had changed it when it came out on VHS, because unfortunately, that's the only way I've really been able to see it is on video. But yeah, that's nasty stuff.
Yeah, I mean, what they had to do was zoom in on the top half of the frame so it looks really grainy. And then they had a handmade mat as the camera moves from left to right. And so it's really shaky. It's much harder. It was much harder in post-production to make a mat look good if the camera's stationary than it when it's moving. So it's when the camera starts moving that bird starts jumping all over the place and looking spastic.
The thing that really got me about Phantom of the Paradise, and I'm very ashamed to say how long it took me until I realized this, was that, you know, when the film opens and we have Winslow doing his song, I didn't realize that that song is the template for the Juicy Fruit song that comes afterwards. It's the same structure and everything, but it's changed so much that it wasn't patently obvious, but it just kind of speaks to how clever the songwriting is in the film, you know, that you can take this really heartfelt song and then change it into this kind of like doo-wop Juicy Fruits tune that they have afterwards. And it's like, oh my God, I didn't realize what was going on with this thing.
You weren't clued in by the fact that both songs have exactly the same first line. I was not myself last night.
It took me forever to figure that out. Yeah, I know. Like I said, I'm ashamed of the fact, but
yeah. And then Old Souls, the song that Phoenix sings, Beef's song is very much based on that. It's the same chord progression and in many ways the same melody.
People don't give Paul Williams the amount of credit that he really deserves. And, you know, he wrote so many popular songs. I guess it's that other people made his songs famous, you know, especially like the Carpenters. Whenever I think of the Carpenters, it's usually hand in hand with Paul Williams. But the guy was really super smart with the way that he wrote those things.
He was. And you know, structuring songs and using bits and pieces of melody from different songs in the same musical, or the same chord progression in different songs in the same musical, is a really common practice. And it's done all over the place so that the songs will sound catchier to the audience. If you've kind of already heard this song earlier in the show, or heard bits of the melody or bits of the chord progression, then it gives you the illusion that you know the song even as you're hearing it for the first time. But in this movie, there's really a great reason to do it, which is that Swan's various versions of these songs are in fact based on what Winslow had written.
And then also, that's you know, obviously that's a tie-in to his character as the devil, that he, you know, he's just ripping things off and recycling things.
I was not myself last night, couldn't set things right with apologies or flowers. Out of place as a crying clown who could only frown, and the play went on for hours. And as I lived my role, swore I'd sell my soul for one love who would stand by me and give me back the gift of laughter, yeah. One love who would stand by me, and after making love we dream a bitter style. We dream a bunch of friends, dream each other smile, and dream it never ends.
Myself last night, lost the fight, my Woody barely running by a dude I should have beat, and on the street a blow like that is stunning. I finally lost control, I tore my tuck and roll off the street where my baby sits up close to me. That's supposed to be what I like.
I I've always kind of been interested in sort of the evolution of the Winslow Leach costume. Do you know anything about like the whole design of the helmet? Where did that come from and how long did it take for them to come to that final design?
Well, that's another thing that everyone claims credit for. Bill Finley says that he designed the mask and that he was going for a bird of prey kind of thing. And Rosanna Norton, the costume designer, also has said that she designed the mask. So it's hard to know, but it looks like, since all the prototypes for the mask look substantially the same, the shape of the mask was pretty well determined right from the beginning. And that mask was made by Sonny Berman, whose brother Tom actually made Winslow's scarred facial appliance and the chrome teeth. And those guys were both working for John Chambers, though I'm pretty sure neither of them got a credit on the film.
It's kind of a testament, you know, that people are starting to, they're doing like fan recreations and, you know, they're trying to build their own Phantom masks. Have you seen this on the internet?
Oh, sure. There's actually people who have gone into business selling Phantom masks. There's at least two mask makers that I know of. You know, Phantom had a lot more success in Japan and obviously in Canada than it did in the U.S. And there's a Japanese company, Medicom. They're the same people who made the Phantom action figures. And a couple years ago, they put out a limited edition full-size version of the helmet. So you sometimes go to Phantom screenings and there's people wearing these helmets.
That's kind of sad.
I think it's awesome, actually.
I went to a screening of Back to the Future and somebody was dressed up as Doc Brown. And I just wanted to say, like, why don't you go out to the car and change, dude?
I would never do that. I'm not that nerdy. My three Phantom helmets, I'll just sit on a shelf here.
Let's talk a little bit about the bands that are in the film. Of course, there's Winslow as Winslow, the singer-songwriter, kind of similar to Paul Williams there. But then there's the Juicy Fruits and the Undead and what was the name of the...
The Beach Bums.
The Beach Bums, thank you.
The Beach Bums, yeah.
And
sure.
Each of them kind of represent, well, and then, of course, Beef. You know, I guess you could say that it was Beef and the Undeads or something like that. But each of them really represents a very specific time and genre of music.
They're also, I think, little mini homages to, you know, real significant bands in rock history, too. The Beach Bums are clearly, you know, some kind of tribute to the Beach Boys. And then you have the latter band, the third band in the film, but they're the clear Kiss tribute.
They would be a Kiss tribute if there were Kiss yet.
There was Kiss, son.
Well, there was Kiss, but nobody had really heard of Kiss at that point. Their first album hadn't come out at the time the film was in production. It had come out by the time the film was released.
Yeah, because Kiss's first album came out in 74 and Phantom came out in 74, right?
Right, exactly. And so at the time they were shooting Phantom, nobody knew anything about Kiss. I keep seeing people claim that, oh, Kiss stole their makeup ideas from Phantom or that Phantom stole it from Kiss. And it was really going on at the same time. I think that, you know, the Phantom makeup is really much more inspired by the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And the whole use of gothic and death imagery and everything else by a band, I think it's much more traceable to Alice Cooper than to somebody like Kiss, where they were brightly colored and trying to be fun rather than all morbid and ghoulish.
And then who do you think that the Juicy Fruits were playing off of?
The Juicy Fruits, I think, were trying to look like Sha Na Na in the sense of being in the 70s but doing a 50s style thing. And in fact, in some of the early scripts, they're referred to as Sha Na Na. And there was an attempt for a while to get Sha Na Na to play that band. And there were problems. And Paul Williams finally decided that he'd rather use people that he could sort of steer through playing various styles.
We were talking a little bit about this, the 70s just being so steeped in the 1950s. I mean, I don't know if we can point everything to American Graffiti or what was going on there, but there was so much where it was the 50s being revived in the 70s, like with Happy Days and all those kind of things. What do you guys think? What was going on that made the 50s so damn popular in the 70s? Was it the return to innocence kind of thing, or just that a musical revival? I mean, it was just a strange thing for me.
You know, I think it is a combination of what you just said, but also, actually, you see this happening again. It's like it skips a generation, you know, like it was in the 70s, and then you would think it would pop up in the 90s, but now you're seeing that, like, 50s, return of interest in 50s in the early 60s. Now you're seeing it in fashion. You're also seeing it in, like, you go to the store and you see lamps and clocks and fans that are all like made of wrought iron, and you know, these lamps have got these weird floral designs on it. I think it's just an interest in an innocence past, and I also think that it's just people wanting things simpler too.
I agree with that, and I think that in the 70s, the people who were the swans of the world, who were in control of music, were trying to simplify things and get music away from its prior role as sort of a social force of unrest, and I think that the movie is commenting about that. I mean, the songs and the film itself, you know, they function as a metaphor for the death of the idealism of the 60s and the declining role of music as a social galvanizing force of rebellion and freedom, and the resurgence of the establishment as it takes over and dominates and stifles an idealistic creative medium. So, you know, it's really clear that, for example, Swan's Biker Thugs are intended to call to mind the Hell's Angels and the ill-fated Rolling Stones concert at Altamont, which was generally considered to be the, you know, the anti-Woodstock and to demarcate the death of the 60s vibe. And so at the time Phantom was being written in around 1970, you just had the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and things were looking really bad for the counterculture, and the establishment and Nixon were reasserting themselves with a vengeance. And so I don't think it's any accident that Winslow starts the film with long hippie hair, and that when we first see Phoenix, she's dressed like kind of a relatively tasteful deadhead. And that as Swan, the establishment, takes over their lives, Winslow's hair gets a nice corporate prison haircut, and Phoenix performs in something that looks like a wedding dress, sort of the archetypical symbol of female subjugation. And then by the end of the film, she's literally getting married to the man. It kind of makes you wonder if the Juicy Fruits might have at some point been creative, talented artists before they became Swan's whores.
And you see that in reverse, too, with the Swan character. You see in flashback that he started out very clean cut. Now he is this hippie.
Right, although there's that one shot where he is in Betty Lou's pendant. She says, oh, this is what he looked like when we were in high school. And he has this long, shaggy hair, right? I guess if he had his hair like that when he was in high school in the 50s, he probably got his ass kicked a lot, which would kind of explain his bad attitude now.
Really says something that the man and the establishment and all these things, the even the music business, all these things that we just kind of lumped onto Swan, that he's made a deal with the devil. Kind of telling about the attitude of the filmmaker and everyone behind the scenes.
You'd also think that, you know, while he was at it, he might have asked the devil to make him a foot taller.
Yeah, you would think. So we should talk a little bit about the casting. I mean, we talked about Paul Williams already, but I mean, I love William Finley in this role, and he was great in Sisters, in that I know that he was in Black Dahlia as well, but it's like, I can't really think of a whole lot of, I guess he was in Simon, the Alan Arkin film that I have a special place in my heart for, but really, I haven't seen him do anything in the last few years, and I don't know what he's been up to, but what was his relationship with De Palma?
He and De Palma have been close friends since they were both at Sarah Lawrence College. And so he appears in all of De Palma's very early student films. He's the lead in Wotan's Wake, and he's in The Wedding Party and so on.
And then he was in Toby Hooper's Funhouse as well.
And then Garrett Graham, I absolutely love him as Beef. He's been in some interesting stuff as well. I love him in Used Cars and, of course, Judd 2.
I think he's also really, really great in another De Palma film called Home Movies, which is little seen.
Good stuff.
But worth finding. And he plays a completely different kind of gay character in that film.
There are variations on gay character.
I don't know. I don't know how much I appreciate the gay stereotype of Beef in the film, but I mean, it's funny, and I don't know if they would necessarily do the same thing today, but I don't know. It kind of works that he's so macho on stage and he gets off and he's just a flaming queen, but the Antlers outfit that he wears, I think, is probably the best outfit in the whole film.
Since we're mentioning the Antlers, shouldn't we mention the fact that, you know, we've talked about the plunger, but that is a blatant tribute to Psycho there as well.
The Antlers?
No, the shower scene.
Life at last, salutations from the other side. Well, I can see it's your devil's pride. Do you realize that all of you donated something horrible you hated that was part of you? Well, I'm your nightmares coming true. I am your crime. Woo! Life at last, sit and listen while the fun begins. Hearts are broken, the bad guy wins. Sit and listen, all the cutting up is easy, and it isn't for the queasy, for the weak of heart. Well, you had better start the home while it's still time.
Sing my music again. Not here, not anywhere, do you understand? Never again. My music is for Phoenix. Only she can sing it. Anyone else that tries, dies.
There's a lot of psycho stuff going on in Phantom. There's also the whole bird motif in Phantom, which is borrowed to some extent from Anthony Perkins and his stuffed birds, and birds being this sort of traditional signifier of death and doom that you see in Psycho. And of course, Marion Crane in Psycho being named after a bird, and most of the characters in Phantom having some bird-like reference in their names, Swan, Phoenix, and so on.
Beef.
But you said you preferred De Palma over Hitchcock.
I do prefer De Palma to Hitchcock, and the reason that I prefer De Palma to Hitchcock is because Hitchcock was constrained by his time into having to do so many things with such subtlety and to not expressing the things that you feel like he might have liked to express with a little bit more clarity with respect to the sexual undertones of the stories that he was telling. And De Palma is able to take what Hitchcock did with film grammar and be a lot more explicit about particularly the sexual issues that he's dealing with. Watching a De Palma film seems, I feel like it's a little bit more liberated than the Hitchcock films.
I enjoy artists working under more restraints, I suppose, just because they do have to be a little bit more subversive. I'm not saying that I don't enjoy what De Palma did with some of the building blocks that Hitchcock was playing with. I enjoy that more than some of the overt violence and stuff that happens. I won't even say in De Palma's films, in other filmmakers' works where they don't have the restraints going on. So I enjoy seeing some of it where you have to be more subtle and you have to work within those restrictions to get your message across.
Because of its blatant aspect, it limits the imagination, I think. And that was the whole point of Hitchcock, was to elicit fear in his audience without showing anything. And, you know, De Palma just gives the goods away. I hate that. I do like Snake Eyes, though. Snake Eyes rules.
I'm not sure if you're being serious or not.
No, I do. I'm being serious.
Okay. Yeah, I enjoy Snake Eyes not as much as I enjoy some of his other stuff, but there are some interesting things that he does in it. I like the opening, especially when he's kind of doing that whole Touch of Evil opening shot kind of thing. And I wish that I could see the original cut of Snake Eyes, just because the whole change of ending, just that they still leave in references to
the big wave
coming in and all that stuff. Yeah, it's just like, you know, oh, I'll never forget how it was down in that tunnel or something, he says. I'm just like, what? What are you talking about?
The De Palma film I really, really like, actually, is I'm a really big fan of Carlito's Way.
That is a great, great movie.
I like Carlito's Way.
I watch it every year.
So what are the misperceptions about Phantom of the Paradise?
There are things that you see on the internet over and over and over, repeated time and again, as if repeating them is going to make them true. This crazy idea that it played continuously for more than a year in Winnipeg, which is just nuts. Or this idea that Bill Finley's scream in the record press scene is real because something went wrong with the record press. I mean, it's true that something went wrong with the record press, but he didn't even know that it was going on until after he'd been pulled out of it. I see all over the place, because this is a story that Garrett Graham has been telling for years, that Paul Williams gave the producers a discount price for the music in exchange for an on-screen role, and that's just nonsense. And I guess the most frustrating one, and the one that I get a lot of mail about, is that there's a remake in the works, because this has been listed on Internet Movie Database for years. That's just not happening. There's been a lot of effort into putting together a stage musical version, but nobody's working on a remake of the film.
Kind of glad to hear that.
Now, if we could get him to cancel the Rocky Horror remake,
oh God,
I'd be very happy.
Oh, don't get me started on Rocky.
All right, so we had the pleasure of talking to Jessica Harper about Phantom of the Paradise. Here's a really quick interview with her. Roll that clip. Phantom of the Paradise is really early in your career. Can you tell me how you got into the acting stuff?
I was in college and not particularly happy, and I was taking a theater course, and my mother, of all people, called me and told me that they were having open auditions for the cast of Hair in New York, and she suggested I go and audition for it, which I thought was a little insane because I'd never done such a thing in my life, never had a job. But I went downtown to this church in New York where there were 500 hippies lined up around the block with their guitars waiting to audition for the show, and I joined them, and I got a part in the show, me and two other people. So I was on Broadway in Hair, my very, very, very first job. So it was just one of those serendipity things. I was in the show for about a year, and then I went on and did a bunch of other theater off Broadway and regional theater as well, and eventually landed in an off-Broadway show called Dr. Salovey's Magic Theater that was directed by Richard Foreman, and it was a big hit off-Broadway. So a lot of people in New York came to see it, including Brian De Palma and Woody Allen's producer came, and various people saw it, and from there that triggered a lot of activity in movies, including, you know, a meeting with Paul Williams for Phantom of the Paradise, and later a meeting with Woody Allen. That's how I got started, and it was from that off-Broadway show that I got, as I say, I went to meet with Paul Williams, and ultimately I was flown out to Hollywood to do a screen test, just like they used to do in the old days, and to meet with Brian, and I was competing against Linda Ronstadt, which made me very nervous, but I got the part.
You went from doing stuff in college and then jumping onto Broadway with Hair. How did you handle the nudity?
We got paid $2.50 extra per night if we were willing to take our clothes off. In those days, $2.50 was a fair amount of money. That could buy you many subway rides. So everybody took their clothes off every night. It wasn't the nudity so much that was kind of a big adjustment. It was the just the whole experience of moving into New York and suddenly becoming an adult overnight, having a job and having to be responsible and, you know, get an apartment and all that stuff, having to start a life so kind of quickly. That was it was a lot to take on for a teenager, but it was fabulous.
Now, have you always been a singer?
Not really. I mean, I sort of was a singer in the chorus in high school. I never was a lead singer. And then I went to college, and I started out being a modern dancer, actually. But then I sort of felt like that was kind of limiting, and I just started playing around with singing. I used to listen to Dionne Warwick records, and I would sing along with her and try to imitate her, for hours on end. And I took a theater class. One of the requirements was that we got up and sang in front of people regularly, and I was forced to get up and sing. And I found, much to my surprise, that actually I did okay when I did that. And my theater teacher was very encouraging. And then we had a big concert, and I brought the house down, and I realized I could actually sing. My voice was maturing a lot, and by the time I got to audition for the cast of Hair, my voice was very developed and kind of really kicking in. It was later, after I did a bunch of musical theater and so on, that I took some voice training and developed my voice even further, but it was pretty much there as I got out of college.
What was the whole Phantom experience like? I mean, that was your first role and everything. How was that for you?
It was fantastic. It was a little nerve-wracking because having never done a movie before, I didn't know that, you know, you have to feel where the light is on your face, and you have to know where the camera is, and you have to hit your marks, and you have to, there were so many things involved. So it was a crash course in learning all those things. And Brian De Palma was really, really helpful. He kind of steered me through it all very well. You know, as I say, it was a little nerve-wracking in that sense, but it was, the people on the cast were wonderful. They were all so talented, and they were funny and kind of crazy, and, you know, we spent 2 months together in Dallas, of all places. You know, so we had a really good time. And again, the director, Brian, is so talented and so able to get good performances out of people that it was all good. That's what I can tell you.
Now, I heard you still have the hat from Phantom of the Paradise. Is that true?
You know, I don't have the hat, and I wish I did have that hat. I don't know what became of it, actually. I just can't imagine where it is. It was my personal hat. It wasn't provided by the costume department. It was a hat that I happened to be wearing at that time in life, and I wore it down to the set, and I don't know, Brian just thought I should keep it, I guess, and it just became a part of my persona in the movie, but I don't know where it is now. I hope some worthy person is wearing it somewhere.
I have to ask about the dance. Did you rehearse the dance, or was that just you?
Well, that was my own, that was my personal choreography. I don't know. It was just a dance I sort of made up when we were, you know, rehearsing the scene. So, yeah, it just kind of came out of the moment. It wasn't like I had a choreographer telling me what to do. It just kind of was what they wanted me to walk up and down the platform, the stage first, and then I walked out into the audience on a platform of some kind, I believe. And I had to have something going on besides singing. I had to do a little movement. So I just kind of figured something out that felt good.
It kind of reminded me of Elaine Bennis a little bit.
Did she do a chicken dance in Seinfeld?
She does she's quite a dancer. She's pretty awesome.
Oh,
so,
oh, I didn't know that. I guess I must have missed those episodes.
Might be an homage. I'm not sure.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The Smooth Sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
GGTMC. Live. For you, fresh air. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
Get ready for the most amazing rock extravaganza in history.
Phantom of the Paradise.
This Halloween, the Baltimore Rock Opera Society will be hosting a screening of one of our favorite films called
The Phantom of the Paradise.
But not only that.
This amazingly twisted Brian De Palma classic will be shown for the first time ever in six dimensions. We'll be showing the film alongside a live band playing the entire soundtrack, singers and costume actors performing alongside the film, multiple projections, audience surveillance cameras, and we will generally be turning this film screening into one of the most raucous and hilarious Halloween events you'll have the opportunity to see in your short, meager life.
Are you ready to rock?
Life and love!
Phantom of the Paradise in six dimensions. October 28th and 29th at the Showtime Theater. That's 9 West 25th Street in Baltimore, Maryland. Only $10. BaltimoreRockOpera.org for more info. Oh my God, just come say it!
Hi, this is Robert Davi, and you're in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
Life at last! Salutations from the other side. I can see that you're the devil's pride. Do you realize that all of you don't have some hope? Or you hate it, that was part of you. I'm your nightmares coming true. I am your crime. Of the evil that you created. Getting horny and damn frustrated. What's this when I'm home, your woman now?
That was Beef's song, Life at Last. Beef, of course, Garrett Graham. But his singing voice is Ray Kennedy, who worked with one of Justin's favorite artists, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys.
And also he worked with the King of Soul, Mr. Otis Redding, and then Jerry Mulligan as well, the great jazz musician.
So Ari, why do you think Phantom still holds up after all these years?
I think it had a really original look to it, for one thing. I mean, I think you've got to credit the production design, all the great sets, the colors, and so on. Jack Fisk did a beautiful job. But I also think what makes it unique, certainly in its time and probably to this day, is that it's got this mix of, on one hand, almost a winking at the audience look at other films that came before. There's a way that it parodies, you know, obviously Psycho and some Orson Welles stuff and so on. But at the same time, it's very earnest and romantic and wears its heart on its sleeve sort of fearlessly. Films like Airplane and other movies that make fun of what's come before are kind of trying to be too cool for school, and they don't take this chance of at the same time trying to get you to care about the characters. But there's a way that if you don't feel for Winslow and feel that the ending is sad when you're watching Phantom, it's failed. And I think that that's a gutsy move to mix those two things.
I'm going to say I tend to agree with Ari in the sense, you know, into what he just said. And also, I think ultimately what it comes down to is I think the music has a lot to play in that as well. You know, the music is really something that's always stood out for me in terms of Phantom of the Paradise. And ultimately, I think at the end of the day, without the music, it wouldn't be as good a film as everyone thinks it is.
I completely agree with that. I was remiss in not mentioning the music, which I love and which I listen to still.
Yeah, that's one of the few soundtrack albums that I have on my phone, and we'll listen to that quite a bit. Ari, you mentioned earlier a little bit about Phantompalooza. What is that?
Well, Phantompalooza is an event that has been thrown a couple times in Winnipeg. The first time was in 2005. Phantom was actually kind of a hit in Winnipeg when it came out. And Winnipeg is this town in sort of the prairies of Canada, surrounded by a lot of nothing. Now the Winnipeg people are going to be really mad at me.
And we've got actually a lot of Winnipeg fans here. So, you know, we've got at least three people that listen to the show from Winnipeg.
Well, that's great. Phantom did play in Winnipeg for weeks and weeks in 1975. And there was a bunch of kids in Winnipeg who would go see it every week. 35 years later, in 2005, they decided, let's show the film in the same movie theater where we used to enjoy it as kids. And they tracked down Bill Finley and Garrett Graham and invited them to come. And to their credit, they showed up and they really had no idea what they were getting into. For all they knew, they were going to be, you know, watching the movie in somebody's basement on a big screen eating popcorn. But well over 1,000 people came and they were treated like rock stars for a weekend and they had a fabulous time. I went up to that mostly as an attendee, but I also worked with the folks who put that together to sort of decorate the lobby like it had looked in 1975 because I, you know, still had all the stuff. So I got to know the folks who put on the first Phantompalooza and worked with them very closely to put together the second one in 2006, where we reunited the entire cast. The Juicy Fruits came a couple days early and relearned their three songs from the film, and they were accompanied by a live band. Garrett Graham actually sang Life at Last. The film was screened a couple times. We premiered the special feature from the French DVD, which was a nice documentary on the making of the film. There were panel discussions. Paul Williams put on a concert. There was autographs. Close to 2,000 people came to that. It was a huge success. When most people think of Phantompalooza, I think they think of that event. We finally did a Phantompalooza sort of 2.5 that was just intended for locals, where all we really did was show a DVD of highlights from the first two. And there's no plans for another one. I mean, reuniting the cast once is kind of historic and amazing, especially 35 years later. But doing it repeatedly would seem kind of desperate and pathetic, like, you know, a Star Trek convention or something. Really, the best part of Phantompalooza for me was seeing the cast get back together. Most of them hadn't seen each other since they made the film, and they were renewing old friendships. And in the wake of that, some of them are working together on projects. I've seen them get invited to each other's weddings and so on. So it's been this really nice thing. That and having them face the fact that 35 years later, there's still thousands of people who found their work meaningful and still love it and are still really into it and big fans. Some of the cast, particularly the guys playing the Juicy Fruits, hadn't been fully aware of, and it was they had a wonderful time.
So now we should talk about the dark side of Phantom of the Paradise, if there is a dark side to it. And I'm not going to talk about Scarface again. I'm going to talk about how original is the Phantom of the Paradise, because you've got something on your site that was really kind of an eye-opener that you turned me on to.
I think I know what you're talking about, and I wish you hadn't asked about it, because, you know, I'm just so positive about the movie generally, and this is pretty much the only thing that I could possibly talk about that's negative. So what you're referring to is in 1971, which was fully 2 years before Phantom of the Paradise went into production, National Lampoon, which was a humor magazine, published a photoplay called Phantom of the Rock Opera. It was in their November 1971 issue, or you could just read it on my site. It's on the production page. So this National Lampoon thing was based on the Phantom of the Opera story, just as the film would be. But there are so many specific story points and even catchphrases in the National Lampoon piece that appear in Phantom of the Paradise that it's just impossible that the National Lampoon photoplay didn't serve as a never-acknowledged inspiration for the film. The National Lampoon story featured a Phantom of the Fillmore, and of course that was the original title of Phantom of the Paradise, who is a naive songwriter who gets swindled out of his rock opera by a music tycoon by means of a contract he doesn't really understand. And the songwriter then goes, and I'm quoting here, insane with anger when he discovers his songs being performed by other people on television. So he gets disfigured and humiliated on Coast to Coast TV while trying to claim his music. He retreats to the catacombs and causes trouble at the Fillmore by stealing, you know, amplifiers and other equipment and causing speculation about a ghost. From there, a girl singer catches his ear her, and he teaches her how to sing his songs, and just to find her relegated to the chorus in favor of a more modern singer like Beef. And then he disrupts a performance at the Fillmore and exposes the tycoon as a thief in front of the whole audience. So that's obviously virtually identical to the Phantom of the Paradise story, except for the supernatural aspects, the devil stuff in Phantom of the Paradise, which actually wasn't added until later versions of the script. So, Mike, I feel like we're almost related in this because you so infamously popularized the similarities between Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs and this earlier Hong Kong film, City of Fire, that Tarantino had never acknowledged. And I guess my impression was that you were a huge fan of Tarantino and you weren't trying to bring him down, but you got accused of being some kind of hater for even raising this issue, which my impression is you did, even though it saddened you. And I'm kind of in the same place. I'm saddened by what seems to me a lack of candor inherent in the National Lampoon piece never being mentioned as an influence here, which is, you know, kind of ironic in the context of a movie that's largely about plagiarism. But at the same time, I have to say I'm not that bothered because none of the things that to me make Phantom great came from the National Lampoon piece. The National Lampoon thing is actually kind of lame. It's not really funny. It's dumb. And the story points in Phantom of the Paradise that were borrowed from that aren't what make Phantom of the Paradise interesting. You know, as we talked about, the great things about Phantom of the Paradise are the songs, the performances, the editing, the directorial flourishes, the production design, and the crazy shifts in tone and its bitter anger while at the same time being sentimental and romantic. And none of those things are in the National Lampoon piece. So I feel like to the extent Phantom borrowed anything from National Lampoon, what it borrowed wasn't worth much. And I don't feel like the authors of the National Lampoon piece are the true masterminds behind Phantom of the Paradise or anything like that. For me, in the end, it's kind of a no harm, no foul thing.
Ultimately, it doesn't affect the movie. It just affects, again, it's another, you know, mark against Brian De Palma. And we forgot to mention earlier that the music for Phantom of the Paradise was actually nominated for a Golden Globe and an Academy Award.
I don't know. Should we talk a little bit about De Palma before we sign off today, guys? Because I know there's a lot of feelings about Brian De Palma. He's one of those hot button directors. It's kind of weird. I don't know if it's that he's just so unconventional or that he's had such a varied career or what it is. But when you mention De Palma, you're either going to get lots of love or lots of hate.
Yeah, and we're not going to do it justice in probably the few minutes we can devote to it on a show about one of his films. But, you know, for me, it's lots of love. Every new De Palma film for me is an event, and I can't wait, and I love them all. Even if I don't like the stories, I love the way that he makes things look and where he puts the camera and how he moves it, and I love his huge set pieces. Nobody does a set piece better than De Palma.
I dislike De Palma because of his lack of originality on all aspects of cinema. And, I mean, ultimately what it comes down to is I completely understand Brian De Palma, and it's fine that he does that. But I can't have respect for it. It's kind of like the way I don't have respect for Quentin Tarantino as well. But, I mean, ultimately, I'll just be honest, and I will say that, you know, over the years, I have enjoyed, I do appreciate a few of his films. Like, you know, like I already said, I'm actually an admirer of home movies as well. And, you know, I love Carlito's Way. I love Scarface. I like Snake Eyes. I like Just to Kill, fair enough, but ultimately what it comes down to is just...
So basically, you like all of his movies, you just hate him as a director.
No, I don't, because there's so many of his movies that I hate, too. Like, I hate Carrie, and I like the earlier stuff, too, but I hate Sisters, like, I can't get over. I have a real difficult time getting past just the blatancy in terms of, you know, how he takes from Hitchcock. It's really offensive to me, and it's for that reason alone that I dislike him, and I'm going to stand firm at that. There's nothing you can tell me that's going to change my mind on that.
You would think of all people that I would be a Brian De Palma hater because of the way that he kind of recycles Hitchcock, but I actually really enjoy what he does a lot of times. I guess I'm right there in the middle. I'm kind of like in every other movie when it comes to him, and I will either really love them or just be completely put off by them. Like, I love The Untouchables, which is weird because it's got Andy Garcia in it, and usually that's an automatic turnoff for me. Love The Untouchables. I love Body Double. I love Blowout. I'm actually a big fan of The Fury, even though I find it completely cheesy, but there's just something about it that I enjoy. Unlike you, Justin, I really love Carrie. I think that's great. Phantom, of course, that we've been talking about. But then Mission Impossible, I love. Mission to Mars, not so much. And like, I really haven't enjoyed the movies that he's made in the last, I guess, like 11 years. Because like Redacted, I just couldn't get into that. The Black Dahlia, I thought was a huge misstep. I thought that it had great potential, and he just completely botched it. I mean, even the casting in that movie was completely wrong for me. Yeah, so I guess I'm kind of right there down the middle. And I still haven't seen Bonfire of the Vanities, so I'm looking forward, you know, when that one comes back out to the theatrical run. So hopefully there'll be like a big 30th anniversary kind of thing for that.
You're in a treat, Michael. You're in for a treat with Bonfire of the Vanities.
I can't wait. It'll be awesome. And, you know, I wasn't a big Casualties of War fan either. I know a lot of people really like that movie, but I like Michael J. Fox, but I thought that he was miscast in that film.
Yeah, yeah, you think?
Let's go through and give our final thoughts on Phantom of the Paradise. So, Ari, you go first.
Well, obviously, I love this movie, and my bias is so apparent from my website that nothing I could say is going to be taken seriously by anybody because I suffer so badly from bias. But I just think it's a fun, wonderful movie from the 70s that there's nothing else quite like it.
I agree. Just like you said, Ari, and that's what's always stood out about the film for me is, you know, my first experience watching it, I could, you know, immediately tell when the credits rolled that I had never seen anything like it, and I probably would never see another film similar to it ever again. And I respond very well to music, and the music for me is, like I said earlier, a very important focal point for Phantom of the Paradise. And I love that it's sort of this tribute to Phantom of the Opera as well. And it's just the art design and the costumes. It is a product of the 70s. You'll never see a movie like it again. And if you haven't seen it, you must see it right away.
Justin, you respond well to music and often bright lights. Like, I remember the time where I had that laser pointer and you kept chasing after it all afternoon. Just like you guys, I would recommend this film to all of our listeners. Relatively easy to get. I know that I think this is probably one of the only films that I've, maybe RoboCop that I've talked about that is so easy to find out there. You can get it through Netflix. You can buy it on VHS, DVD, any of those things. Ari, is it out on Blu-ray yet?
There's a French Blu-ray, and it's well worth it. They did a beautiful job.
I've still got Phantom on Laserdisc, baby.
Nice.
Okay, so we'll be back in a few minutes after this preview of Coming Attractions.
A great classic comes to the screen.
Say thy hand, fair prince.
Who said I'm fair? To be or not to be? Not to be.
Columbia Pictures is proud to present the screen's greatest action hero, Jack Slater.
Slater! Don't even think of Slater, you hear me?
This is the Lieutenant Governor.
Slater, here's what I...
The Governor gets here, call me.
And Danny Madigan is his biggest fan.
Jack Slater 4.
But tonight, a magic ticket...
It's a passport to another world.
...will get Danny closer to the action... ...than anyone ever dreamed.
Who the hell are you?
Don't shoot me. I'm Danny Madigan. I'm a kid.
And you're going with him.
Who is this twerp? And where is that smile on his face?
I don't even know this kid.
To a world that's bigger than life.
This ticket is magic, and it really works.
And better than real.
You really believe that you're inside a movie, don't you?
Yes! The bad guys are in there. I've seen it on screen.
Could I speak to the drug dealer of the house, please?
Have a nice day.
Have him killed.
That's a preview for next week's show. Be sure to tune in. We'll be joined by the guys from The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema talking about one of Justin's favorite films and one of my least favorite, The Last Action Hero. Sparks will fly!
Ding, ding, ding! That's because it's way too complex of a masterpiece for you, Mike.
So that's all we have time for this week. If you enjoyed the show, or even if you didn't, please spread the word. Let your friends know about the Projection Booth.
And be sure to visit the show's official website at projection-booth.com. And then there's iTunes and as well Jackalope.
You know, I realized last week that if folks are listening to us now, they figured out how to find us. So now it's just a matter of getting them to leave some feedback. All right, well, big thanks to our guest this week, Ari from the Swan Archives. You can visit Swan Archives, see all kinds of deleted scenes and all kinds of good stuff at swanarchives.org. Thanks again, Ari, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
All right, and we will be leaving you this week with some Paul Williams doing The Hell of It. Roll on thunder and shine on lightning.
Roll on thunder, shine on lightning. The days are long and the nights are frightening. Nothing matters anyway, and that's the hell of it. Winter comes and the winds blow colder. Well, some grow wiser, you just grew older. You never listened anyway, and that's the hell of it. Good for nothing, bad in bed. Nobody likes you, and you're better off dead. Goodbye,
goodbye.
We've all come to say goodbye,
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 goodbye.
Born defeated, died in vain. Super destructive, you were hooked on pain. And though your music lingers on, all of us are glad you're gone. If I could live my life half as worthlessly as you, I'm convinced that I'll wind up burning too.
I mean, the karma's so thick around here, you need an aqualung to breathe.